Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome back to Kotaku Split Screen, the only podcast ashamed of both our words and our deeds. We're all playing the hell out of Star Wars Jedi Fallen Order, a very good Star Wars game that's a cross between Sekiro, Metroid, Uncharted, Assassin's Creed, and a billion other things. This week we talk about the game's difficulty, how it balances its exploration with its huge set pieces, and how fun it is to swing a lightsaber at stormtroopers. We also talk about the new Half-Life VR game and Google Stadia, a streaming service that did not blow many people away with its launch this week. We close things out with some off-topic talk and some smooth jazz. All right, let's go! And we are back for another episode. My name is Jason Schreier, coming at you live through the power of podcasting. Maybe not live. Coming at you recorded through the power of podcasting. I'm here with Kirk Hamilton.
Hello. Live as well. Live and in the flesh. Kirk Hamilton.
And Maddie Myers.
Also alive. Not necessarily live, but here. You know,
alive
as well.
From New
All
York.
All podcasts are live if you believe in yourself.
It's so true.
If you believe strongly enough, then all podcasts can be live podcasts. Hello, how are you guys doing today?
Good.
Pretty good. You
doing
know?
Great.
Another week.
Up top, we should another week, Maddie says, resigned tones.
Still alive.
I'm doing great. Week. I'm so great.
Things are great. Everything is great in the world of digital media. Top, real quick, next week is Thanksgiving here in the U.S., as many of you know. And so we're probably going to be recording a few days early so we can take a little break for Thanksgiving. Kirk is traveling. And so we're going to do a mailbag episode next week. So we have a bunch of questions saved up, but if you want to submit some fresh ones, you can reach us at splitscreen@kotaku.com with your mailbag questions. Ask whatever you would like. Just be interesting. That's all I'll say. Just be interesting.
Ask challenge interesting yourself.
Yeah. No pressure, but be interesting.
Be interesting. That's my advice. Just be interesting. Don't be boring.
Wow. I mean, come on. Okay.
It's good advice
anyway,
in general. Like,
we have
yeah,
a lot
don't
to
be
get
boring
to.
In your lives also, but
it
also
is true. Good advice. Don't be boring. Yeah, whenever I think like that's like good advice for journalism in general is don't be boring.
Interesting. It's a little vague, but yeah.
Well, I think that every single story that you write just could be better if you cut out the boring parts. Like that's how I think of it. Right?
You know,
just,
that's fun because as an editor, I always cut out the word interesting because ironically, it's not interesting.
It's not an interesting
it's
word.
It's my other hot tip. Hot writing tip from me.
That's a good point. But it's a useful word when talking about whether something is worth covering or not, whether a story is worth telling or not. Is it interesting? Mm-hmm. Anyway, we digress. There's a lot to talk about today, including some video games. We're going to talk about Star Wars. Finally,
sure.
Star Wars Jedi Fallen Order is out. We're going to talk a bunch about Google Stadia. But first, why don't we talk about a few games we are playing that are not related to Star Wars. Kirk, why don't you start us off?
Sure. I'm going to start off with everybody's favorite subject, a couple of board games, because those are the things I've been playing a lot of Star Wars, and the two things I played that aren't Star Wars are two tabletop games that I just want to recommend because they're both fun, and I think listeners might like them. My tabletop group and I played two games. One is called Mysterium, and one is called Concept. Do either of you know either of these two games?
Nope.
Okay, they're actually kind of similar, and so I can just really quickly kind of nutshell them both, and they're both really fun. Concept is a game where they're both limited information games. So Concept is a limited information game where you have a term, like maybe your term is Batman, and then there's a board with a whole bunch of abstract images that can be associated with different things. Sometimes it's like a shape or like, a, you know, almost like 20 questions categories, you know, an animal, a fictional thing. And you place these markers on the board that outline different concepts. So you can have concepts and subconcepts, and you're trying to communicate the thing. And it gets more and more difficult as you go higher up in tiers, and it gets really hard. It's a pretty fun game. And it's like, it's a fun game because you develop a language with everyone that you're playing with. So the longer you play, the better you are at communicating the ideas to one another. But it's a little bit like Code Words, like that kind of game where so it's like a more advanced version with this really funny board, and there's this whole lexicon. And it also does a clever thing that Code Words doesn't do, where the teams, you play in teams of two, but if you're playing with six people, like two people will be giving the clues, and then the next two people will be guessing, and then the next round it moves around by one. So you're always on a different team, and you get a different number of points based on guessing and not guessing, which is a cool thing. I've never played a game that did that before, where the teams change every turn. You're not actually on a set team. You just are always working with someone. And then when you're guessing, you're working against someone because you want to guess first. So pretty fun game. The other game is Mysterium, which is also a limited information game. In this game, you are, one person is a ghost, and the other people are like psychics at a seance, and the ghost is trying to communicate who killed them. And so it is a little like Clue, because you have to guess the killer and the place they killed the person and the weapon. But it's also a little like Concept, because the way that the ghost communicates is with these beautiful abstract pieces of art that are on cards, and they're very abstract. So you'll be trying to communicate, okay, the bagpiper guy killed me, and you'll drop like a picture of a weird robot creature like opening a bunch of pipes, and you'll have to look at it and think, okay, well, there's pipes in this, so maybe that's the bagpiper, but it's a robot, and so there's also the lady who makes watches, and like maybe it's mechanical. And so it's very weird because there's this abstract layer to it, and I don't understand how you can actually design a game like this, because so much of it is like a group of people, you know, all the psychics can talk and try to figure out, okay, I guess that's what that means. And
but
you
the
try
ghost
to
can't talk? How do you affirm whether they've gotten it correct or not? Are you allowed to do that?
No, yes, but it's because the ghost cannot talk through the whole game, but they can knock. And they can knock once for no and twice for yes. So you'll get like, they'll point to you,
you know,
and then they'll
like
knock
ghosts
once.
Do in real life. This
exactly.
Classic.
It's very,
it sounds
very
like
ghostly.
Pictionary with people who just like cannot draw.
It's like, yeah, it's like reverse Pictionary with beautiful art that is extremely abstract from the concept. It was it was very fun. It's a weird game, but a fun one, and I recommend it. So those games are Mysterium and Concept, both very fun, good games for the holiday. Pretty approachable, not super hardcore, and yeah, they were fun.
Maddie, what about you, other than Star Wars, which we will get to shortly?
I'll talk about Star Wars in a minute, yeah. I just wanted to shout out, a friend of mine had a birthday party at A4cade, which is a arcade that is also a bar, but I can't call it a barcade because there's a guy who has trademarked the word barcade, and he is very litigious. That's
really?
Just a fun fact for everybody.
I didn't know that.
About the word barcade. You can Google that and find out about that guy whose name I'm forgetting, but he exists. Mm-hmm. Anyway, A4cade. It is a fun location in Boston for anyone who's ever in Boston. It is in the back room behind a Roxy's Grilled Cheese, which is like this very hipstery, like fun kinds of grilled cheese you can get. And then like there's a secret door, secret-ish door where you can go behind there, and there's a huge arcade, and it's also a bar, which is fun in and of itself. And I just enjoyed playing some games with a lot of people who ordinarily don't play games. And that was sort of the vibe of this party. And it meant that I got to play Mortal Kombat 2 with people who were significantly worse than I am at Mortal Kombat 2, but I gave them a lot of pointers. I don't know if you guys have ever been in this position where you're playing a game with a whole lot of people who are significantly worse than you, but it can be really fun because you're teaching them how to play the game and you're like doing some move that they don't understand. And then I really enjoy getting to explain to someone. It feels very cool,
that
but also like getting to show someone how to do something. And then if they actually can do it, then they feel great. You feel great. It can be really, really
it's
fun.
Like a lesson. I kind of want to play fighting games with you now and have you show me how to not suck at them, because that would be pretty fun.
It can be fun. I feel like there was a time in my life when I was the sort of person who enjoyed just beating people at a fighting game and never explaining what I was doing. And that time in my life is very much over. And now I am old and enjoy teaching people things. I delight in it. If I can teach somebody how to do something in a game and they can do it, and then they are so excited about it.
Spoken
so,
like
that
a
was
true
super fun.
Editor.
I know, right? I know.
It's like the Morpheus Neo scene in The Matrix, where you're sitting there blocking all their attacks, and like Neo is trying to hit Morpheus, and you're like, no, try harder, be faster. But then they finally hit you, and you're like, you are the one. At least that's how I'm picturing it playing.
It was exactly like that. But also, we all had cocktails.
Also, like every single flashback scene in Jedi Fallen Order.
Yes, yes, actually.
Yes, it was very Star Wars. The young Padawan had to learn from me. It was it was great. I'm Obi-Wan in this scenario. Anyway, nice. Jason, what are you playing?
So real quick, so I talked a little bit about Layton last week, Layton's Mystery Journey, which is the seventh Layton game, just came out for Switch. And I talked about how I was enjoying it. I'm still kind of enjoying it. It's a good low impact game and I'm going to keep playing it. But something that I have noticed as I played it more is that all of the puzzles are so friggin' easy. It's like they feel like they're designed for a much younger audience, which makes sense since this was designed for the phone originally, and presumably it was meant to appeal to younger gamers who might be playing on a phone and not have played Layton games before. But it's become almost painfully easy to the point where I'm just like groaning every time I deal with a puzzle, and it's just like, oh my god, what? This is over in like 2 seconds. So that's been pretty disappointing, especially because Layton games tend to have some fun, challenging puzzles. And then when they are challenging, they're challenging for dumb reasons. Like there's some stupid trick that you have to notice, or like you have to see something that is not easy to see, or like that most people wouldn't see. And for example, there was one puzzle real quick that was like, it showed a picture of a bookcase. Like picture you're looking at a bookcase and the books are in weird positions. So like a few of them might be attached to like the top of a particular shelf on the bookcase. And so they look like they're like violating gravity, and then maybe a few more attached to the side and a few more attached to the bottom on another shelf, and they all just look weird. And it's like, okay, in this bookshelf, what's the minimum number of books you would have to glue to their shelf to keep them in place? And so I'm looking at it, I'm like, okay, I'm trying these different guesses, and then eventually it turns out that the answer is zero, because you were supposed to notice that on the background of the bookshelf there's like red carpet, and it's actually a bookshelf that's positioned so it's on the floor. None of them are really glued. And it's like that sort of dumb puzzle answer where you're just like, okay, that is not satisfying to even figure out. So yeah, been kind of disappointed. I kind of withdraw my recommendation for that one, even if you're a big Layton fan. But I've been just like having fun as like a low impact, like playing this before bed while my mind is fried from feeding a baby for the past 2 hours type of game. All right, let's get into the good stuff. Last Friday, Respawn, the developer behind Titanfall and Apex Legends, came out with Jedi Fallen Order, which is the first single-player Star Wars game in at least 10 years, since I think Star Wars Connect was the last single-player Star Wars game.
Primarily single-player, right? Because Battlefront 2 did have a single-player campaign.
Right. I'm saying, primarily single-player. Yeah. Single-player only. And then it is... fair to say that it's a pretty good game, and we can get into all of the details there. We're not going to spoil the story or anything like that, in large part because I don't think any of us have finished it.
Beaten it? No, not yet.
But we've all played a bunch. Kirk had a very unique saga over the past
Yeah, I want to hear about this.
But first, just like overall impressions, and I'll throw it to you guys in a second. But overall, if you're not familiar with this game, a good way to describe it is like a mixture of like the climbing and exploration of Uncharted, with like the sci-fi backtracking and adventuring of a Metroid, and then the combat, and this is the most surprising part, of Sekiro, or like a Dark Souls game, where to the point where it's actually surprisingly challenging, which is I think part of the real appeal of this game. But overall, there's nothing in this game that you haven't seen before. It's like a good hodgepodge of familiar mechanics and ideas that just work together really nicely. Maddie, let me throw it to you first. What are your overall impressions of Jedi Fallen Order, and how much have you played?
I've only played a few hours so far. I was in New York for some of this week, so that really cut in my gaming time, but I really enjoyed what I've played so far. I find the climbing and the fighting to be really satisfying. I think also that you just said the game is challenging. It's challenging if you want it to be. I've been playing it on normal. I would not say it's challenging on normal. I have absolutely no problem with that, and I'm genuinely wondering, like, should I kick up the difficulty? Because I know that you, Jason, I think, and then also Joshua, who reviewed it for us, were both recommending like go up to Jedi Master or whatever the hardest difficulty is. But there's something incredibly satisfying about just wrecking shit as a Jedi, and my headcanon has always been like Jedi are freaking awesome. Like, they can just block a blaster and headshot a guy with their lightsaber without even thinking about it, and I can do that that as Cal Kestis in this game, like just immediately block every blaster shot and like whatever. The parry window, like the window of forgivingness is pretty wide on normal mode. You can make it even wider if you want to go down to easy, but it's not hard parry stuff. I don't know. I find it very fun to like wreck stuff in this game. So
what part are you up to? Like what planet are you on?
Man, I don't know. Whatever the freaking first one is. I'm not as far as you guys.
Early. Okay,
Bogdo, so, Bogato.
Okay, so you're really early. So,
Jedi
okay,
Land.
So Jedi the way Land. That the game is structured, it's pretty interesting, actually.
Does it get harder?
It
Go ahead.
Gets
Tell me.
Significantly harder, and there are like actually some really big spikes when you get to some bosses. And mm-hmm. I think I'm entering the part of the game because I'm towards the end. I just got the double jump, which comes later in the game. Like I think I'm probably 75-80% done. And you get
We're
going to the
gonna
point
talk
where...
about the double jump in a minute when we get to Kirk, but... It's fine.
And you get to the point, yeah, I saw the look of grit, like the grimace on Kirk's face and I said,
don't
I
don't talk
the
about
double.
The double jump. We can't talk about it yet.
Maddie, so it gets to a point where it gets much harder. First of all, the standard enemies that you start fighting turn into, it's fewer like one hit kill stormtroopers and more like badass purge troopers who
and
take a lot more
parry,
in a fight.
Parry,
yeah, and you gotta
many,
do
many
a lot
times.
More work. And then also,
what difficulty are you on though?
So I'm on Jedi Master. So the second.
So of course,
highest
it's hard for
one.
You. Yeah. All right.
No, but even on that, at the beginning, it was easier. And then also, the boss mm-hmm. fights don't really start for a while, other than okay. that one optional one on Bogano that everyone talks about, Agito Bago. But the real like story boss fights start getting really tough later on, like around where I am. So that I think makes a big difference, and it doesn't. It's kind of like a weird spike. It's very spiky.
Game. I guess I'll find out how it is on normal and I'll let you guys know next week what I think about it. Mm-hmm. I might change the difficulty. I just haven't decided yet. But I'm enjoying it a lot so far. Also, the climbing is wild, but I really want to hear Kirk's story. So maybe we can talk about the climbing later and how fun it is to watch
Kirk.
Cal climbing on stuff.
We've been building it up, Kirk. It's time.
Tell us your story.
Oh, well, I will tell my story. So yeah, I've played this game twice. Jason, I'm to where you are now.
Because you loved it so much?
Well,
right?
It's funny, kind of. I mean, I wouldn't have played it the second time if I didn't like it, so that is true. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so in terms of how far I am, Jason, I also got the double jump and beat the boss after the double jump, and I'm pretty much where you are.
And, I'm up to that boss. That's where I stopped last night.
Okay,
tough
I beat
boss.
That boss.
And really tough
so I'm
boss.
Actually past. Wow,
that's so funny.
I got past you. So yeah, I want to share my pithy summary of this game, which is Star Charted Wars Prime of Persia Jedi Die Twice,
mm-hmm. cool.
which I think is captures everything about it.
Did you rehearse that in front of the mirror before we recorded this?
No,
episode,
I wrote or? It down. I just
cool.
wrote it down right here.
Cool.
But so yeah, it's like Uncharted set pieces. The whole thing is draped in Star Wars. It's got a Metroid Prime map and a general feeling of Metroid Priminess. The Prince of Persia thing I think is important. This game really reminds me of Prince of Persia, both Sands of Time and the 2008 one. Just the mm-hmm. platforming and the puzzles in the sort of tombs that you go to. I would say they're very Prince of Persia. You like the feeling of a big room that you can jump and platform around on and move things around and the way the room unlocks and you gradually get higher and higher and higher in it. It's like a distinct influence. And then Jedi Die Twice, right? Because as much as I can make jokes about rolling through urns and how that feels like Dark Souls, it's really like Sekiro. Mm-hmm. Both in the combat, the way the combat and parrying works, the way you have to whittle down someone's stamina before you break their guard, the fact that you can fall to your death and you don't die forever like you do in Dark Souls, the same thing in Sekiro. You just lose a chunk of health. And then also the structure, I think, is important as well. This game takes the Dark Souls Sekiro structure of meditation points that if you rest and get your health back, it respawns all the enemies. If you get killed by someone, you have to go get to them again and hit them once to get your XP back. Like that structure is also like a really significant thing for them to borrow for reasons that I think are interesting. I'll get into in a second. Okay, let me tell my story. I'll tell it quick because it was already recounted.
One thing real quick before you get into
sure.
that is my understanding actually is that they had a lot of the bones of this combat system in place before Sekiro even came out and was revealed.
Yeah. So. I would say it's more of a point of comparison than than I want to say that they were influenced by it necessarily. Mm-hmm. Like
Okay.
It's
give
just
us
that
a story.
It feels closer to that. Okay, so yeah, I played this
Why
game.
Why did you play this game twice, Kirk?
I played this game, so I've been playing also on Jedi Master difficulty, which I'm finding cool.
Man,
it's
you guys
hard.
Are metal.
Well, and I've having played a ton of Sekiro, I was like super ready for it. And it's so similar. Like the feeling of just like being in a sword fight and waiting for the attack and hitting the parry and then following up, like, really does feel like good.
Even the way it's like you get in three hits and then they'll attack you no matter what. Like it's always three hits that is.
Or like memorizing when there are enemies that attack really fast, so you counter them and they do a really quick follow up. But once you get that, you can like hit them twice and then get it. It feels similar.
Yeah, that can be fun.
I'm with Joshua Rivera. I read his review. I agree that the combat is like a little off. It's not Sekiro combat. I don't think, and this is Respawn's first melee combat game, like credit to them. It's like really fun. It's just that when you put it under that stress test of a higher difficulty, Sekiro is like a really fine-tuned Lamborghini of combat. That game, it's just like really good. This game is a little more, it's like not quite sticky. It feels a little weird. It's frustrating. You can get kind of backed into a corner and weird shit happens that isn't, it's not hard in the right ways sometimes. But I do like Jedi Master. Okay, so I played through the game. There's this planet, there's like four planets in the game, I think. There's a planet that you unlock called Dathomir, is that it? And it's this like, the planets are basically jungle planet, ice planet, like plains planet, and hell planet. And Dathomir is the hell planet. And you unlock it really early in the game, and
well,
you can go there.
Well, to be fair, jungle planet is Kashyyyk, so that's like a pretty,
But it's a cool jungle planet.
Yeah, still an
very cool jungle planet, actually, when you go there later. But jungle planet. So hell planet feels the most like Dark Souls. There's literally an NPC that you talk to in the world who ends his first thing you say to him with, heh, 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 heh. That's the end of the conversation. I was like, wow, guys, like that was on the nose.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it's amazing. And you can go there really early, which is a cool thing the game does, is it lets you visit this high level, very difficult place at the beginning. And you
very
can't
get Metroid of them.
Very Metroid. And like you can't get that far. Like there's tough enemies and there's this one big dude who kind of will really wreck you, but you can beat him. And you can even get a pretty cool upgrade if you really make it all the way in, which is nice for people who are good. You've got to be good. I didn't get there on Jedi Master until way later. So then when I got that far on Jedi Master, this was significantly into the game. I'd gotten like two of my main upgrades, so pretty far in. I'd unlocked all four planets. I go back, I'm exploring, and then I see this jump that looks like a pretty far jump, and I'm like, oh, I don't think I can make that because I don't have the double jump yet, but I try it. I'm like, well, I'll try it. And Cal does this weird thing where he just jumps late, like he basically double jumps. I was like, oh, what did he just double jump? Or and then he makes the jump, and I was like, well, I made the jump, and I didn't really think about it. I was just like, I guess it was closer than I thought, or that seemed weird, I don't know. And I just kept going. And so really shortly after that, you hit this cutscene where the floor gets knocked out from under you, you fall down into this new area on the hell planet, and you have to get out. And so I'm like, okay, I'm going through, you meet a new kind of enemy, kind of do some fighting. And then I just got to this place where I could use force pull to like pull up this gate, and then I had to make this jump that I could not make with a single jump. And there was nowhere else I could go. Now, this game does not have fast travel. And it's a cool thing about the game most of the time, because you'll beat a boss and you'll be really far into a level and you have to make your way back to your ship. And it's actually kind of a fun process. You re-traverse the level. There's like new gate pathways opened up and stuff. So that's like fine. But there's also no save backups. There's no way to load an earlier save. You get the one save. And I was just stuck. And I basically soft locked my game. I was like, it took me a long time. This is Jason. And you were in this text thread. I was texting some of our friends being like, is this seriously happening? And I was asking some friends, and then it became clearer and clearer. I found more people that had this happen to them in comments thread, that I was just boned. Like I was stuck, you know, and I was far into the game. I'd played like a lot on Friday and a lot on Saturday. I really was liking it and wanted to finish it. And so here I was 10 hours into the game thinking, holy shit.
So sad. I felt so bad for you. We were texting on Friday night and I was like, oh my God, I feel so terrible for Kirk.
Yeah, it's awful.
It was one of those things though that winds up being, this is a very standard Kotaku writer instinct, is like when a shitty thing happens to you, you like lean into it and it becomes an interesting experience. Because I decided, okay, I could just quit or come back later. I'm pretty burned out and I can't imagine playing this again. Or I could just do it. And what I wound up doing, and it did wind up being interesting, was I kicked the game all the way down to the easiest setting. I restarted.
Oh, interesting. So you've tried it on very
I have.
Easy.
I've played it, now on all three difficult, or the main three difficulties, not the ultra hard death mode or whatever. Like, fuck that. The first three. So I wound up, I played someone normal, which I agree, Maddie. It's like not hard, but it's fun. It's a really fun game. It's just, you can totally get through it. If you just like Star Wars, it's a great way to play. You feel like you're Star Wars. Like it's more than, I don't know, like Force Unleashed. It's not just brainless. You have to kind of, you can get into the combat system.
It is normal.
And
it is between the two points.
Right. It is not easy and it is not super hard. It is normal.
So true, man.
So eventually I was like, well, this is kind of dumb. I've already done all this. I'm just going to kick it down to story mode difficulty, it's called, and just blast yeah. through this shit. And that's what I did. And it was a really interesting experience. I got a few like observations from the game. First of all, I made it a rule not to do anything that I hadn't already done. So I was like, I can't go beat... I hadn't beat Ogdo Bogdo. Is that his name? That
yeah, something
in the first
like
area.
That. Great name.
I hadn't beaten him. I'd been planning on... I was like, I'm going to relish kicking your ass when I go back. Mm-hmm. But I hadn't yet. So I'm like, I'm not going to go beat him on easy mode. I'm just going to save him. And then mm-hmm. when I catch up to where I am, I'm going to kick it back up to hard mode. Because one of the great things about this game is you can just change the difficulty
at any time. Love it. Mm-hmm. Love when games
Which
do that.
Which is important, actually. I will say, there's like one place... the place where you have to fight in a kind of an arena. I don't think that's too much of a spoiler. It's fuck not, that shit on care. Hard. I was like, I'm not doing this on hard. Like, I just kicked it down. Oh,
well, so I did that on hard. And, well, that's one of the spikes I was telling Maddie about.
Yeah,
earlier,
there are some spikes.
So I did that on hard. And actually, I kept dying. And then what happens is eventually they take it easy on you, because if you get to the final boss of that arena and then mm-hmm. you die to that, you don't have to do the other fights
oh,
first.
Oh, I didn't know
oh,
that.
Just it just resets you to the final boss. Mm-hmm. Got it.
Got it. I was like, yeah. if I had to redo this again, because I only got there on normal.
One of the most interesting things about this game, and one of the conversations I keep imagining as I play it is, and we can get, I'll let you finish in a second, but we can get into this more later, but one of the conversations I'm imagining in my head is the battle between like the Respawn designers, who probably wanted to like crank the difficulty up and like make it as Souls as possible,
yeah.
and like the mm-hmm. people at EA and Lucasfilm who are like the producers who are like, no, this game has to be playable and accessible to people, and like we got to get this game out to millions of people,
well,
not just like the hardcore.
I feel like the game, oh man, I really want to talk about that, because I think that's the most interesting thing about the game.
Oh,
but
yeah,
let
totally.
Me finish my story
but
really
finish
quick.
Finish your story. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah
and then
yeah.
then we can talk about that, because the difficulty and the soulsiness of it is all very fascinating. So anyways, I blast through the whole game on easy, which is pretty fun. Man, you can just run up and just kill shit. Like, it's like
that's
really...
So funny.
Like, I would just be, like, fighting a big
they
thing.
They should
that
call
just...
that mode Jedi Master, actually. Like,
right.
I don't know if it would
totally
make any
right.
sense.
That's a really good point.
That's totally true. The easiest should be Jedi Master. And then, like, the hardest should yeah. be, like, shitty Padawan.
Padawan. Like, you're a fucking youngling, okay?
Right.
You don't know what you're doing.
Who's, like, getting killed
That's
by
so
basic
funny.
Scrub, like,
yeah.
you know,
totally.
Aardvark
it's
enemies.
It's like, yeah, that whole, the, remember the Wolfenstein thing where it's, like,
yeah,
baby
it's so
mode?
Dumb.
Really, baby is the hardest mode of all.
Yeah, you're playing as a baby. You are a baby.
To be a baby. That's very, very true.
That is a great point.
So I was playing on Jedi Master mode, aka
cool.
the easiest mode, and I
You're
was a total
as
Jedi,
a Jedi Master.
Master.
Yeah.
Right. Yes, I was playing as a Jedi Master against a bunch of scrubs, and kill everything in sight. It's very
that sounds
satisfying,
great, honestly.
And it was cool to play through the story really fast. So I was like 10 plus hours in, and then it took me like maybe four, a little bit more, to catch up to where I was.
Wow.
I missed a few things, a few collectibles. So what I've been doing is now that I have everything unlocked, going back through all the planets and finding all the stuff, which is a very fun thing to do. And what was interesting was this game really has these interesting gear shifts between big set piece things and the Metroid parts of it, and they stand really apart from one another. The first level of this game, this is something I used to do when I would review games too, or be writing a tips post, is I'd have just played like 80 hours or something, and then I would make myself go back and play the first 2 hours again, just mm-hmm. to be like, okay, what's a new player gonna be thinking, what are they gonna be wondering about, and also just what is the initial impression of this game, which can be so instructive. And the mm-hmm. initial impression of this game is bananas awesome. Like, if uh-huh. I had played a whole bunch, and then I went back and played that first level where you're like at this shipbreaking facility that Cal is working at undercover mm-hmm. before
Brackus.
The Empire discovers
Brackus.
Him. It's so amazing. Like, it looks like an E3 demo, like the whole thing.
Yeah.
When those Uncharted things kick in, there's a couple of the other ones too. The one on Kashyyyk is very like that. And I think that was an E3 demo, if I recall correctly.
The tree.
So, yeah, before that, when you first land on the planet. It's like,
oh,
I think
yeah,
that was
yeah.
an E3 demo. Anyways, it feels just so slick and like so impressive. The camera is doing all this rad shit, and like there are these things that'll happen. Like, you'll go flying off of the thing on a train that like falls uh-huh. apart. Like, just like ridiculous, like a Naughty Dog level. Bonkers uh-huh. stuff.
Or even and sometimes the camera will just zoom out while you're climbing up something
yeah.
and you'll see the whole vista, and it's just
mm-hmm.
astounding.
Yeah. And like how far Cal could fall if he only ever fell, but he won't because he's a Jedi. He'll never
he's such
fall.
A master of not falling. So anyways, yeah. that was a cool experience. And just like blasting through the story again, it made me see like how the story is not like the thing that draws me to the game, really. And playing through it a second time made me see like the predictable twists and stuff a little more. But the performances yeah. are good. I was happy to watch everyone like do their lines again. And once I really knew what was going on.
Yeah. And they look incredible. The faces are
oh,
just,
yeah.
The animations and the faces are just
they've really
out of control.
Yeah, they've really done video games have arrived in terms of like me just believing
faces. Yeah.
Yeah, like people are just talking to one another, which is cool. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then the only other thing I noticed is that the game is very, very good at the map is just amazing. Like, and the way that, especially at the beginning when the map is showing you where to go and your new places to go, these maps are so big and sprawling. There's no fast travel. They really do a great job of indicating, okay, now you can go here. Now mm-hmm. this yellow thing, it tells you can go here. This red thing used to be closed and now it's green, and that means you have an ability. Like, it's very user-friendly in a way that I admire.
It takes some getting used to, like the 3D mm-hmm. map exactly. takes some custom, but once you're adjusted to it and once you get the hang of it,
right.
it's really, really good. Yeah.
And totally. It was cool being adjusted to it since I'd played 10 hours, going mm-hmm. back and seeing how they introduced you to it. And I was like, oh, I totally know how this works now. And this is very smart. Like, the way they're showing this is really cool.
So, Oh man, where to even start? Okay, so
the difficulty thing, right?
Let's talk about the difficulty. Yeah, the accessibility thing. So that's such an interesting, like, I don't know if this debate actually went on, but I imagine that there was at least some forms of this debate of like, how much should we let the player
probably,
in on?
You know, people were even arguing both sides of it, right? Like, I'm sure people were aware of.
I mean, I feel
challenge.
Like this game is an interesting answer to that debate, and it's a fun answer because it shows that you actually can make a game like this and have an easy mode and just have it be a very different game, but also just have it be something that exists.
What I mean is the question of like, so when you play a Dark Souls game, it doesn't tell you what anything does. It won't tell you that this bonfire is gonna respawn all the enemies, and everything is left to you to figure out in those games. This is almost the opposite. It tells you everything. Everything is made very clear. It also can be really punishing and challenging, but it is extremely forgiving in a way that Souls games are not. If you fall off a ledge, you do not die. You come back
Sekiro,
with like a little bit
Sekiro,
of your health come back. It's very, oh yeah, Sekiro does that too. That's true. But it's got that accessibility. Like, even the fact that a map exists at all, it's got that appeal that I think is meant to broaden the scope of this game so that more people can play it, which I think is an interesting idea and an interesting conversation that, like, should a game, I mean, well, not should, but like, what does a game look like when it is expanding to that audience? Does it sacrifice anything along the way? And I guess I'm curious to hear what you guys think. Do you think Jedi Fallen Order is sacrificing something by kind of evoking Souls and Sekiro, but also signposting everything and giving you giant indications as to what to do at any given time and not really leaving you with any sense of mystery in the way those games do?
I think that it's not so much a Souls game as it is a Metroid game. So I love that because I feel like Metroid games, they're also old and they are also a design influence on this game. So I don't necessarily see including a map or clever signposting, visual signposting or otherwise, as being like a step back. I guess compared to Souls games, it is. But Souls games doing that was unusual because so many other games don't do that and like actually do try to hold your hand a little bit.
So to me,
I'm like, that's always the thing that I struggle with in Souls games and in Bloodborne, as listeners to this show know. Even when I was playing Bloodborne on the show, I was like, I can tell it's almost Metroid. Like, I'm chill with re-entering the same area and defeating the same enemies 1,000 times. How many times have I done that in Metroid games that I have replayed multiple times? Like, I'm happy to do it. All the enemies respawn in the same freaking area. I'm going to play it 1,000 times. That's fine. But those games just purposefully don't hold your hand. You just have to remember it. And like, Metroid doesn't do that. Like, the first Metroid game does it, and you know, that game has its strong points. But after that, they really help you out. Like, Super Metroid is like super freaking well designed in terms of signposting. I think that's good. So I don't know. I think it rules that this game makes it really clear which stuff you can grab as you walk by it. Like, they show you a certain kinds of things that look grabbable, and they're like, this is what these things are going to look like. And every time you explore this world, you're going to be able to tell where you're supposed to go. And that rules to me. I don't know.
Yeah,
I like it when a game does
it's
that.
It's an interesting tension. And Kirk, you mentioned before that the Uncharted parts feel at odds with the Metroid parts. And I do feel like...
I don't know about
kind of,
at odds. They're a contrast. I don't
they
think
feel
they,
like a contrast.
I think they work in the same game together.
They feel dissonant in a lot of ways. Well, it feels like half the time you're on a roller coaster ride and half the time you're like exploring and getting into the vibe of that.
I think it's like more like you're exploring a theme park and then occasionally they put you on a roller coaster ride. I actually think it works to break up the tension. Like, it's fine because those are two things that
I'm not saying this as a criticism. I think it's just an interesting mishmash. Yeah. I think it works. So far for me, it's worked really nicely. If I have one complaint, it's just that the exploration isn't as rewarding as it could be because so many of the chests are just just cosmetic items, and so I would have liked to see like something more interesting.
Jump
than
boots, for example,
ponchos.
A spin attack. Come on, bring it on.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it would have been cool to see. Maybe not all the abilities are unlocked with your skill tree. Maybe some of them you find along the way, or maybe you find items or something like that. Kirk, you had mentioned to me when I was complaining to you about the, or I was complaining about this on Twitter, and you said something about how you liked how it doesn't. It's not a game that forces you to be in menus at all. Yeah. And I thought that was a good point. So yeah, it's a game that I think does both of those things really, really well. I do kind of feel like it feels like there could have been innovation and there isn't, and maybe it's like I'm almost hoping that the sequel will bring some level of innovation or some element to the game that I haven't seen before, because this year in gaming, the games that really stood out to me were games that have done things that I've never seen before in games, like Outer Wilds and Disco Elysium and Baba Is You and like stuff like that. So to just be playing this kind of comfort food video game it's cool, but I don't know. I guess I kind of hoped for more. Do you guys wish you saw more innovation in this game?
Well, I have some thoughts on difficulty that I haven't shared yet. And let me share those a little bit, because I think that that's like, to me, the most interesting thing about this game is the way that it, you know, it's this clear hodgepodge that is a very pleasing hodgepodge. And I think that if you just want to play a fun video game for however many, 20 hours, like, hell yeah. And you like Star Wars. But I do think that the thing of this question of like, what does it take away from and add to the formula of a Souls game, by kind of the basis is like very Souls plus Metroid. Maddie, I think you're definitely right that like the Metroid influence is just as much a part of this game as the Souls influence. And you know, we've seen a lot of games do Metroid in different ways, and fewer games do Souls in this way, or like experiment with the Souls formula, and I think that's why I tend to latch that.
Usually when a game experiments with the Souls formula, it goes all in, like Neo does, or like Code Vein, where it's just like straight up.
So far, right. Yeah. There have been a lot that follow the formula pretty strictly, and it is a very difficult and very like uncompromising experience. So there's kind of three types of difficulty, or three types of, you know, elements of the difficulty in a Souls game that when I think about it, there's the straight up difficulty of a fight, just like, can I beat this thing without it killing me?
Like reflex-based.
Yeah, just like how hard is fighting, like how punishing and aggressive are enemies. There's the opacity of the game, which is the part you were talking about, Jason, where it's like, is this game a mystery to me? What am I supposed to do? Yeah, where do I go? How does any of this work? What is this weird talisman I have that has like a cryptic thing on it?
Does it matter, or can I just pick any old thing?
Which is often frustrating. I mean, for Bloodborne, when I played Bloodborne, I was like, fuck it, I'm using a walkthrough because I don't have time or like space in my mind to deal with this shit. And some of it is so esoteric that it's like, I remember we were talking about that one thing where you're like, in Bloodborne, you have to use some random item on an eyeball and then wait for a while. And it was just so ridiculous.
It ruled. Maybe, but it was great.
Some of that stuff is really cool and people like it. I mean, the opacity of Hollow Knight is a huge part of what makes it great.
Yes.
I have another thought on that, but just for the third element, and this is just a thing that is sort of essential to FromSoft games, is the massacre element of the game, the way that the game occasionally is abusing you and you're enjoying it because the joke is on you very often in those games. There are a lot of sequences. It's such a thing in the language of a Souls game, a Soulsborne game, whatever, Sekiro, I'm including all of these under this broad umbrella, where you'll see a cool item and you go to pick it up and a giant fucking thing falls on your head and you get wrecked.
It's like slapstick almost.
Yeah, and you learn, you're always in this tension with the game and thus with the designers of like, what are they planning to do to me next? Like, I'm in a new area. Clearly, I'm going to be the subject of some pratfall or other, and if you really, you know, occasionally you'll see the monster waiting up high and be like, I see you, fucker, you're not gonna get me. And then sometimes even that is like a fake out and another one is behind you. So those things, so to go maybe in reverse order, those things do occasionally happen in this game. There are some funny times where a guy will wait for you and you'll charge him, and then the dude is like hanging out and will get you, which is cute. But it's never quite as much of an element of the game, and that's okay. It's just like, it is a personality shift. Like, this game doesn't feel quite as diabolical and kind of, you know, poking at you and fucking with you in that way. So that's a difference in the experience. The straight difficulty, I think, is pretty similar. Like, it on Jedi Master, it's pretty hard, and I get killed a lot. And it's like, because of the opacity stuff, the game just feels more forgiving. And in general, it's not as hard as Sekiro. I mean, I'm definitely going to finish this game on Jedi Master, where Sekiro, there came a point where I was like, fuck, man, like, this is so hard. I just don't have the hours and hours and hours. Like, there's no Genichiro fight in this game that I've come across. Like, nothing that freaking
hard. It's funny you say that because this game makes me want to go and revisit Sekiro. But yeah,
oh, yeah. I mean, yeah. It's worth revisiting. It's great. The opacity thing is interesting, though, because it's made me think a lot about the games I've played this year. And Jason, you mentioned three of them, actually, that are, like, are very interesting contrasts. Baba Is You, Outer Wilds, and Disco Elysium. There's this difference in the feeling. It's like I've been articulating, I guess, in the last few episodes, but it's the feeling of when the game itself is a mystery that you're solving versus when you're just playing the game and the game is explaining itself to you. And they're really two very different kinds of games. Death Stranding is such a good comparison to this game.
Yeah, I was surprised you didn't mention that, Jason. It's such an important game to you. It's just a real standout for you.
It's fascinating that they're both out at the same time because they could not be more different. They're so different in every way. And I'm like, really like them both. But there's that feeling of like, what's going on? What do I do? Where am I supposed to go next? Outer Wilds is literally, that's the entire game is like figuring out what you're supposed to do. This game, right, is like so much more transparent. When you rest, it tells you enemies have respawned. There's a map and it tells you very clearly where you're supposed to go. And I like that too. It's definitely,
what if Jedi Fallen Order 2 has you carrying around Baby Yoda and you have to see Baby Yoda?
And it's amazing. Entirely any, like, menus. Senses. Like, they play Death Stranding and they're like, people have menus. I don't know.
Clearly,
people
have backpacks and they have menus. Their inventory.
You got to add in a bunch of that.
So I think that those are all interesting. Like, I think this game works very well at what it's being. And, like, changing one of those would really dramatically change the game. I do think that maybe a little disappointment people might feel with this is that it's such a straightforward thing. And there was a feeling, I was talking with Stephen Totillo about this a little bit, about when BioWare made Knights of the Old Republic, there was a feeling there that BioWare, like, uncompromisingly made their kind of game, and they just put Star Wars, put it in Star Wars, and that was so cool, because we'd never really played a game like that in the Star Wars universe, and it was, like, amazing. Like, it was this, like, BioWare game, but it was also Star Wars. This feels more like Respawn took a bunch of ideas from a bunch of people and didn't make quite as uncompromising a game, where the thing that would have been closer to that feeling would have been straight up, like, FromSoft made a Star Wars game, which probably would have been really cool. It just would have been different. And it doesn't, you know, diminish what the one thing is. It just makes it a little bit less uncompromising of this, like, one weird thing, and more of a feeling of, like, it was made to be a really appealing, pleasing, cool game.
Totally. And it is. And it's like, that itself is such an achievement after the past 10 years of Star Wars games. And so I have a thesis actually involving this. So
I love
so
theses.
Here's my thesis. I feel like this is the game that had to be made in order to break the curse of Star Wars. Like, there had to be a game that just came out and it's just good. It's just solid. It's just like a game that people won't think of this as like greatest of the generation, like greatest of the decade, greatest of the year even. But people think of it as like, oh yeah, that was a really good Star Wars game. I really enjoyed playing through that. And now I think it gives Respawn this opportunity. So what I've heard, and I know this is going to be a Reset Era thread, so shout out to them. But what I've heard is that they already are getting, like, they already have a green light to make a sequel, which I think is pretty obvious. Like, obviously, there's going to be a sequel to this game. I haven't finished it yet, but I'm sure that the ending sets up for, like, DLC and a sequel. So there's going to be a Jedi Fallen Order 2, short of disaster. But I think this game had to be made to be like, look, we're going to go conservative and just do this, like, really solid job on this, and then for the sequel we can explore some, maybe some crazier ideas, some more innovative stuff, and just like try take some weird wild risks. But I think because of the history of Star Wars games and all the Star Wars games that have tried to that whose developers have tried to make something ambitious or risky or big in some way and just like got it, wound up getting it canceled for various reasons that are well documented, I think they just had to be a little bit more on the conservative side. And I think given that, like, with that mentality in mind, it's just super impressive that they were able to do this, because this could have so easily been like a Call of Duty style, like, super linear campaign where you're just like going through and mashing
what
buttons.
What is a Call of Duty Star Wars game exactly? Like, what? That is a whole other idea.
Well, I don't mean...
You are a stormtrooper and you're fighting alongside a bunch of other stormtroopers.
I don't mean in terms of tone. I mean in terms of structure, where it's like you're playing a mission.
It's just a linear.
It's just a mission,
where it's a roller coaster,
a
and there's a big set piece, and then you fight fight in the
movie. I mean, that's the Force Unleashed was basically that.
Yeah, exactly. That's what it's. It could have been like the Force Unleashed again. And I think the fact that they were able to put in like all these other influences, like the Metroid stuff and the big open worlds with like side paths you can find and optional bosses, like that itself is just like so cool to see, and it really just like finally should give people hope. It certainly gives me hope for like the future of Star Wars games, so that's pretty cool to see.
Yeah,
as a result of this,
I hope the sequel does, if they're gonna add things in the sequel, I hope that they add somewhere you can go and do Dark Souls style multiplayer lightsaber duels, because that would be really
cool.
That
would be great.
Oh my god, yes.
I also hope that they get a little more creative with the story in the sequel, because
be nice.
This story feels incredibly by the books, and also like it's basically the Star Wars Rebels cartoon with all the characters' names changed, and that's fine. I'm glad they're fans of that cartoon. I like it as well, but it's also like maybe, you know, have like a little bit of a different story in the Star Wars world. But I get that they were like lightsaber fighting. That's really easy. That's what everyone wants to do, and the game very
well,
much
it's
checks
always
that
such
box.
I feel like it's always, you're always screwing yourself when you're like, okay, this is set between episode 3 and episode 4.
Yeah, it's like, what?
Immediately, you're just like, what are you going to do?
It's funny because, well, and watching The Mandalorian at the same time as playing this game, The Mandalorian feels much more like, oh, this is an exciting and different thing. Where the game, I go back and I'm like, oh, this feels like kind of like a New Hope, you know, vanilla version or something. Something from the prequels. So,
what do you guys think of Cal Kestis? Maddie, you wrote this funny post today about characters that look like him.
Well, because it's been a common joke among people
like
to like describe him as Archie Andrews, or to describe him as like Scott Fargus, or like any number of other redhead characters from other pieces of media. And so I just did a post that was
I'm looking at this right now. I hadn't seen this.
just jokes I've heard. Like, people just describe him as Archie. Josh made a joke in his review about how he looks like Archie. Yeah. And he super does. But anyway, it's fine. I don't think he's that exciting as a character, but I also get why they don't want or need him to be. But hey, maybe there's all sorts of reveals later where I learn the truth about Cal Kestis.
Maybe it turns out that he actually has black hair.
Whoa.
What? A protagonist with black hair instead of red hair? What are video games doing? They're innovating, I tell you.
Don't you think that it kind of sums it up? I think that he is interesting enough. And it's like him being a redhead and not a guy with short dark hair like every other, like the guy from Force Unleashed. Like, he's like interesting enough. And I think the actor who plays him does a pretty good job. And he gets these nice scenes and they get this nice mocap. And it's like,
he's like,
it's
kind of funny. He's got some good little jokes. I mean, that's all you really need from a video game.
And BD-1 is great. I really like the droid.
BD-1 is fantastic.
I'm a fan of the droid.
Agreed.
It's a good droid.
Yes. Very good
droid. Wally. Star Wars Wally.
It's definitely top five droids.
Top five droids. Is that
Star
one
Wars
of your
droids ranked
list?
He's up there. Definitely the most useful droid we've ever seen in anything Star Wars.
Like, what? R2-D2? Come on, man. Like, you
don't
think
know.
He was useful?
BD-1 has a lot more abilities than R2-D2.
Remember the snitch droid? Is it in The Last Jedi when there's that snitch droid that's like an Imperial droid that spots the little roly droid and is like, and busts
that
them?
Droid is useful, just not to the people that we want the droid to be useful
precisely.
For.
Precisely. He's useful for the bad guys.
Okay, cool. Any final thoughts from you guys on Jedi Fallen Order before we move on? Okay, let's take a break and then we will talk about Google Stadia, among other things. And we are back. Kirk, Maddie, let's talk about some Google Stadia, which is finally out this week. But actually, first of all, man, this week a new Half-Life game got announced.
What?
Which I think under normal circumstances, Kirk, you would be freaking out right now. You would be like, Jason, you have to go play Half-Life 2 so you understand what all the fuss is about.
You do.
Maddie, I don't know if you're a big Half-Life fan, but
of course I played Half-Life. We talked about it on the show. It's okay, though.
But it turns out that this week's Half-Life announcement is actually a VR game. Valve announced Half-Life Alyx. They haven't actually said anything about it. I think they are going to, probably the day that this show goes live, so the day after we are recording this. But there's a new Half-Life coming out.
And Kirk and is still freaking out because he loves VR so
Kirk,
much.
How do you feel about this?
I feel mixed about it. I mean, I don't know about loves VR so much. I like VR. I have a VR headset plugged into my PC that I have not really used in months. So I don't know. Yeah, I love Half-Life 2. Jason, you need to play Half-Life 2, man. Just you're like
a, like, what are you doing? You're,
as,
at least
you're
watch
you're
a bona
fides,
it.
Man. It's so good.
And isn't that the game that we have to play, like, for the predictions?
No, that's Far Cry 2. Or mine was Far Cry 2.
Oh. It's really funny that you mix up Half-Life 2 and Far Cry 2, but I also completely understand why you would.
I didn't mix them up. Half-Life was a different year.
That's right. I think we did.
He's tried to get me to play Half-Life before.
You should, man. Oh,
and
man.
You failed two? Each time? Wow.
Yeah,
okay.
I know. So they're such, they're really good. They're still good. So anyways, I love Half-Life. I'm interested in what this will be. It's about Alex Vance, who is the main sort of the main speaking character in Half-Life 2. I would go so far as to call her the main character of Half-Life 2, basically, because like you're a guy who doesn't even talk, and it's almost a joke how he doesn't talk, and she's like there talking all the time and like reacting to the story like an actual character. So I don't know. I guess we'll find out what it is. I'm curious. Like if it. I'm guessing this is going to be some kind of side thing that doesn't continue the story, because Half-Life 2 Episode 2, which is a really awesome expansion or like standalone episode, ends on a cliffhanger that people have been waiting, you know, whatever, years and years and years, 15 years or whatever.
Many years,
10 years for some kind of, you know, conclusion. I guess it's been 12 years because 2007 was the orange box. So, yeah, I want to know what happens next. I'm guessing this isn't going to tell us what happens next. But Valve makes really good VR games. I mean, The Lab, which is the thing that launched with the HTC Vive and is you can now play on a Rift. It's free. It's just like an Oculus thing. It's this cool. It's like kind of like you're in the Aperture Studies labs as a VR thing, and you can go into different rooms and do different games. There's all kinds of different stuff. They're all like really good. There's a bow and arrow game that's still like one of the best bow and arrow things I've ever done in VR. So they really know what they're doing with VR. This could be really fun, but right, like you said, I mean, it's VR. So you play for an hour and get a headache. Or like some people can't play at all because they get motion sickness, and like not everyone has a VR headset and whatever. Like there's a lot of downsides that come with it too.
And who knows if it'll only be like the Vive as opposed to
or like who's VR writing it. It might feel weird. It might be like people are writing it who had nothing to do with Half-Life because it's been so long. Like none of the people are even there anymore.
Right. I was going to say that. Yeah. So I was going to make that point. So here's an interesting theory. So yeah, first of all, most of the people who worked on, I mean, Mark Laidlaw, whose name is most associated with Half-Life games, hasn't been involved in a while. And like a bunch of people who worked on those games are just not there anymore. Presumably they tried over the years to get Half-Life 3 done and it just never happened for whatever reason. And we know it's been public info that Valve tried to get other companies to do Half-Life episodes and they just fell through. I believe Junction Point, Warren Spector's studio, before they made Epic Mickey, they were contracted to do a Half-Life episode that was canceled. But anyway, so here's a theory I've seen on Twitter, and I like this theory. I don't have any inside info on this, so I don't know if it's true. But a bunch of people have noticed that the Campo Santo people, this is the studio that made Firewatch and was bought by Valve last year. So they had announced, or earlier this year, I don't remember exactly when, they had announced a game called In the Valley of the Gods that got this great trailer at the VGAs last year. Looks fantastic. And that was their big thing that they were working on when they were purchased by Valve. But some people noticed recently that a bunch of people who work there suddenly took that game off of their Twitter profiles. If you go to the Campo Santo website, whereas a month ago it said, our next game, In the Valley of the Gods, that game has been totally scrubbed from the website. Mm. It just says they're like, it just says like the creators of Firewatch. So it seems internet breadcrumbs suggest that that game is canceled, which has led a lot of people to theorize, what if those people are actually working on Half-Life Alyx? And so maybe we'll have the answer maybe by the time this episode is live, we'll have the answer to that because they'll have announced more details. I don't know. But I do think that's an interesting theory. Those are super talented people who made Firewatch, which is a cool game. And
yeah, I mean, even if it isn't, there's a lot of talented people at Valve. Like, it is more likely than not that it'll at least be a good thing. Like, that's well made.
So yeah, so that was just the big news of the week. And then the other big thing that we should talk about, of course, is Google Stadia. Google Stadia, I think all three of us have been pretty bearish, have been pretty pessimistic about Google Stadia since we found out that instead of pursuing the Netflix model of like you pay a subscription and play whatever you want, they are actually selling games on the service. And I checked it out earlier today. We have one in the office and I looked at the store and it's just hilarious that it's like some of the games you get a discount for if you're a member of their premium subscription model, Stadia Pro or whatever it's called. And I think you have to be right now in order to use it. So everybody who plays it currently is going to get a discount, but it's not all the games.
I think that in order to use it, I believe that you also have to buy that $129 bundle.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
which is like, what? Like that.
Yes, you have to buy the bundle with a Chromecast and a controller.
Anyways,
yes.
Carry on. That is ridiculous.
So I looked at the store and it's like Red Dead Redemption 2, $60. Now, I don't know for sure. I'm actually going to look it up as we talk what you can get Red Dead 2 for, like right now, if you buy it at GameStop or something. But the fact that you would have to spend $60 for a copy that only exists on Google servers of a game that came out a year ago is just like absurd. It makes no sense to me. Who is out there buying it? And then so I was like, okay, so we've heard some feedback from people who said that when we were asking back in the day, a few months ago, we were like, who is Google Stadia for? Because I think that's a question that a lot of people ask. Is it for the person who doesn't own a console? If so, would they really buy a game? Well, we've asked that question a bunch of times. Mm-hmm. And so a couple of people reached out to be like, hey, I'm into games. I don't want to spend a bunch of money or can't spend a bunch of money on a high-end gaming PC. I want to play Stadia on my like normal PC or screen or whatever, tablet, and get 60 frames a second and like 4K resolution, because that's the appeal of this thing. But as of right now, you cannot actually do that for most things. So it's a lot of things about this launch have been very confusing, and there's a lot of just like various factors that play into everything. But Red Dead 2 right now, if you play it on a screen using the Chromecast, like sit in your living room and do that, it only runs at 30 frames a second. It's super hitchy and stuttery from what I played. It doesn't run super well. There's like that very clear half a second of latency that's kind of inconsistent, and Red Dead 2 is already a pretty sluggish game. It already feels like you're just like struggling to control Arthur Morgan. Imagine that with that extra like latency. It's pretty brutal. And then I believe on the browser, if you play it on a browser tab, you can get it at 60 frames a second, but only at 1080p resolution. So you're just like making compromises all over the place, which I think is just like Google Stadia in a nutshell. It just feels like this very scattered, half-baked launch. And they're not calling it an early access or anything, just a beta. But it just sure feels like that. What have you guys seen? I know neither of you have really played with Google Stadia, but what are your thoughts having seen the launch reactions to it? Kirk, you want to go first?
Yeah, it feels to me like an incomplete launch. Like it just is not, you know, like they're just getting this out there now. And there's so many different ways that this could go that I just don't know. Like it feels very strange to me that you have to buy the games individually. Clearly that's the biggest problem right now. Mm-hmm. Let me think. I have a lot of thoughts and they're sort of jumbled. Let me try to put them in order. So first of all, it seems like they want to get the technology working in time for next fall when the new consoles come out. This feels like this is the initial launch of this brand new thing. They want to get it working. They're Google. They can, you know, bleed money for a while and like get the infrastructure in place and then maybe add new features and make the thing better. I could kind of see that happening. It's missing a lot of features. They said we're going to be there. Some of that multiplayer stuff and other things they'd announced just aren't in there at launch. There aren't that many games right now. They're not new games. They're kind of older games. And yeah, you have to buy them. Like I looked and on Amazon, you can get Red Dead Redemption 2 on PS4 for like $35 used. So it's almost half that price that you would pay for a version that if Google shuts down their servers, you can't even play anymore. So not great. There's like a version of this thing that kind of works right now, like Destiny 2 works on it. I could see if you were really like Destiny 2 is your only game and you wanted to just bring a Chromecast and plug it into your laptop over Thanksgiving when you're visiting your family and like keep playing and you can play the game and it looks good and works. That's cool. Like, that's a pretty small niche.
Real quick on Destiny 2. So I played that I tried playing it on the phone, on the Google Pixel, and that was wild. But because you have to plug your controller in, it wasn't working wirelessly for one reason or another. You have to hold it in a weird way, and it's not super comfortable to play. And then I tried playing it on the TV as well through the Chromecast. It was 30 frames a second, which itself was jarring to me, being so used to playing on PC. There was definite latency. It was stuttering a little bit. It ran pretty consistently, but, and here's the huge but, I tried to play Crucible and was just sitting there waiting for 15 minutes and there were no matches available. So no one's playing. Don't know if people are actually playing, and that ultimately is going to kill Destiny.
Yeah, one that is like, that gets at the thing, like even there, you need cross-save for that to work. Like the whole, I play games on a dedicated system at home, but I want to play on the go. You'd need to be able to pick up your progress, which Destiny has, but not every game has. And I don't know if every game on Stadia is guaranteed to have that. And that's already a pretty niche thing anyways. Like, it's like just being able to you know, wanting to like own that many different things. So when it comes down to it, I look at this and it's like, well, this technology is promising. It feels like everyone, like it's easy to agree that this idea of like a streaming game service that works perfectly and you don't need a console and no one needs a console and you can play it anywhere and it's like Netflix, only it's video games, is an amazing idea and that at some point maybe we'll get there. And I get why Google's trying to do it. If they can establish the technology and get that working pretty well, and then introduce a service that I would actually want or someone would actually want, I could see it working, because that's what seems like the market to me, is the person who is like, oh, I would totally pay whatever, $15 a month to be able to play maybe like year-old AAA games or just a mixture of games, because I don't really like keep up with stuff or care. And then I could just not deal with it and just plug a thing into like a little dongle into my TV and play whenever I want or play on my phone and like just play whatever game came out last year or like good AAA stuff. And that,
AKA what Xbox is doing already, which is going to like blow this out of the water. That's what they're doing with xCloud. And xCloud is going to be compatible with Xbox Game Pass, and so when that starts really launching like across all of our platforms, that is basically going to be what you just described.
Yeah, that seems like a good service that people would want. This right now, like, does not. Like, I don't understand.
No, not at all. It's for nobody. Like, that's the question, right? When everyone asks who's it for, it's for nobody. Maddie, any like initial thoughts from seeing all the reviews and reactions and just knowing what you know about
Sega? My initial thoughts are that Mortal Kombat 11 and Samurai Showdown are on Google Stadia. I have seen none of the fighting game players who I follow have tweeted about this at all, because I don't think any of them are playing those games on Google Stadia. But I would like, I'm waiting for Mike Fahey to come back. He's been sick, and I'm waiting for him to come back. We were DMing a little bit while he's off about those games and how I'm like, I just want to hear how those are on Stadia, yeah, man, because he also plays fighting games and has Stadia. So that's the coverage I'm waiting for, yeah, is those games with lag.
Right.
What the heck is that? And yeah, because of that, I like hearing that Destiny has lag. I'm like, yeah, any competitive game. That's not what this is for. No. You know, this is for single player games. This is for people, insofar as it's for anyone. I think it's for single player games. It's got to be. I can't imagine anything else ever working at all.
Yeah, and this is all like even just beyond this, the questions of like, oh my god, how much of my bandwidth is this draining? I think I saw a VentureBeat report that it was like 100 megabytes per.
Oh yeah, that's a whole. That's a whole other question.
Yeah, well.
It's like, if you have a data cap.
And then how much electricity is this taking? How much? It's 100 megabytes per minute at 1080p. So that's like unbelievable. The impact this is having on the environment, the amount of power that it's taking up, just like so many friggin' questions and such a disaster of a rollout. And it just so feels like even aside from all this, even if it wasn't working perfectly, if they had come out with a business model that actually made sense, that didn't require you to pay full price for friggin' games, then like maybe this thing could have had a lot more potential. But right now it just feels dead out of the water unless they're prepared to change that business model straight up.
That's the thing. Like, I think I'm not as like, this is a disaster of a launch, I don't think, on this. Like, I wouldn't describe it that way. It just feels like a weird launch and an incomplete one. It feels like there's room for them to figure out a model for this thing to work, and I understand them doing this. Like, the messaging around it is weird, and the marketing around it is very weird. Like, they're selling it. Like, that freaking trailer that I watched was this, like, really expensive, like, max production trailer, like, selling this, like,
what, Stadia? Stadia is only the newest, most logic-defying, mind-bending, absurd gaming platform on Earth! Forget boxes, forget consoles, just your games, your screens, and electric air. And this electric air is Stadia!
Oh god, yeah, I forgot to watch that.
It's like, it is a major product that you can get now, and I'm like, that's not how I would be describing this, but if this is part of a plan
but that's
to
the
like
thing. But that's what Google saw it as. Google really saw this as,
right,
what I've heard from some folks who are connected to Stadia people involved with this launch in some capacity, is that, like, first of all, that morale is pretty low and has been for a few months now, at least, and second of all, that they expected this to be a way bigger launch than it was. Someone told me that pre-orders are lower than they expected it to be. I think they sold out of like their Founders Edition, but they were selling another edition, and they did not. I think they were expecting this to be a bigger deal than it was. And it's worth noting, Sorry, Phil Harrison. I'm gonna criticize you here. Phil Harrison came on our show. He was like cordial enough. He was generous enough to give us his time at GDC and answer our questions about Stadia. He is the guy who's in charge of Stadia. But like, this is also the guy who oversaw two of the worst gaming launches in history: PS3 and then the Xbox One. And now, third time has not exactly been a charm for him. And I think that if you look at the PS3's turnaround and the Xbox One's turnaround, those both came after he left. So not exactly a glowing track record for that guy's managing of these console launches. It's worth noting.
Yeah, I think it's something that we'll keep an eye on, and like, maybe, I mean, it's, I'm not going to get a Stadia account or start playing Stadia games, but it could be they figure out some way to make it work. It doesn't look great, especially knowing that they thought that if people were going into this thinking this is going to be huge, like, that just shows a really fundamental misunderstanding of the dynamic. But if there are people there who are level-headed and are like, okay, we're getting this technology working, we're gonna find some way to meet this market that does exist, then I could see that would be a little more reassuring. But yeah, I don't really know.
I'm sure there are some people who feel differently. There are a ton of people at Google, but I think the mentality was like, here are some huge numbers we're gonna hit in the first year of launch, and like, here's what we're going for, and we're going to take on the next gen consoles. And like, I think they had ambitious plans for this thing. And I remember at GDC, I think it was 2018, so the year before they actually announced the thing, when Google was just like quietly talking to developers and stuff, there was a lot of like really positive buzz. People were really excited about the stuff Google was doing, especially involving some of the features, like you're watching someone play a game on YouTube and you immediately jump in exactly where they left off, and none of that stuff is actually working right now. So yeah, maybe you're right. Maybe we give it time and we see what happens. I mean, maybe this will be the same story as all those live service games where it's like, well, rocky launch, but they really fixed it at the end. But I think fundamentally, the one thing that they have to change is the business model and the fact that you have to pay for games. Yeah. And if they can do that, then that'll change everything. If they don't do that or can't do that, then this thing is just never going to be what they want it to be.
Yeah.
Straight up. All right, we will discuss this more in the future. Why don't we take another break, and then we will quickly rail through some off-topic stuff, because we're already running long. And we are back. Kirk, Maddie, let's get through some off-topic stuff before we say goodbye for the week. Maddie, why don't you start us off?
Sure. So I watched the first season of this show, The Righteous Gemstones. Oh, man. Have you guys heard of this show?
I know it, but I haven't watched it.
Yeah, how is it? I've seen the ads. So, it looks funny.
It's very funny. So John Goodman stars in it. He's great. I don't remember any of the other actors' names. Forgive me for that, listeners. They're all very funny. So this is a TV show about some extremely rich televangelists, essentially. They run a bunch of mega churches. They're very... they're not necessarily good people, but it's very funny to watch them try to hawk the brand of Christianity that they're selling. And it also is sort of a surreal show. Like, it's not fully taking place in our reality. Like, their version of the world is just a little bit more heightened than ours. Mm. Like, there's this character who's my favorite character, Keith, who's like this former goth who like converted and is sort of like a born again character. And now he like worships all the characters and is like, I'll follow you anywhere. And you like meet all these other goth characters who are like comedically obsessed with Satan, like to a level that like no group of actual goths really is.
Sounds like a cartoon. Almost.
It's kind of cartoonish, but it's super funny. And like all the scenes with the goth characters, I loved so much. So it's almost like all these sort of stereotypes of those tropes of humans, and they're just elevated to comedic effect in this show. And it's very enjoyable and fun. So I recommend it.
Nice.
How about you, Jason?
I'll go real quick. I finished Big Mouth season 3. Kirk, I was going to text you, but forgot. That season really ended on a downer.
Yeah, kind of surprising.
But it was great. I thought it was a really good season. I especially enjoyed the final episode with all the superheroes.
Lyft monologue, the Lyft driver monologue, like the funniest thing ever? It was during the credits at the end of an episode. He's just talking about things Lyft drivers do.
Yeah. Coach Steve.
It's like Coach Steve just going, and he just goes and goes.
Yeah. Amanda was like, all right, let's get to the next episode. She got so sick of
it. Oh, that's funny. We were just laughing harder and harder as it kept getting better.
I think I'm glad that Coach Steve was delivered in small doses this season, because I lost it every time he showed up.
And a little bit of Coach Steve goes a long way.
Yeah, no, exactly. Like, all you need is, like, a couple of lines from him, and I'm just done. Like, everything that he says just kills me. Anyway, great show. I really like it. Really excited to see where they go with it. Because, yeah, I think, to your point last week or the week before, I think very clearly this is going to be the show, a show where they talk, where next year they're in eighth grade, and then the year after that they're in ninth grade. I think they're very clearly setting it up as, like, a long story with a long game that, like, the kids will actually age, and then it'll end. And I think that's really good. I'm glad they're doing that. I also started his Dark Materials, and Maddie, to your point, my thought the entire time was, wow, the Daemons are, like, insignificant.
They're barely in there.
It also made me really want to go and reread the books, which I've been wanting to do anyway, but, like, this is reminding me that I have no idea. Like, I completely forgot the entire story, so I want to go reread.
Reread the books.
Also, maybe you'll just enjoy the show. Maybe the books. Shouldn't reread
no,
the books.
No, reread the books. They're so good.
I don't know. Reread them. I want to reread the books. But I do remember, like, Pan just being way bigger presence in the books.
Yeah, I think I mentioned this, that episode two has a lot more hot demon action in it than episode one.
Okay. Yeah, I haven't gotten
it. It does, but there's still not enough
no,
for me.
Right, right. That's... Okay. There's still the thing where you look at a big group of people and there's, like, no visible animals, or there's a cat and a butterfly, and you're like, where the fuck is, where are the panthers? Like, where's the gorilla demon? Where's the bear? Like, what's going on here?
How's Lord Asriel getting around? He's got this huge panther demon. Like, how are people not noticing that when he's, like, going around? Anyway, whatever.
Yeah.
I also really like the actor who plays Asriel. I think all the performances in the show are
John McAvoy,
really
is that his name? James McAvoy?
Yes. Yes. Kirk, what about you?
I am, well, let me think. Mine is a book, but also the second episode of The Mandalorian was dope, and I just want to say that.
I haven't watched it
yet. It's really good. It made me be more okay, this is like, I get more what kind of show this is, so that's cool. The book that I've been reading is a book called Musicophilia by Oliver Sacks, who is a neurologist. He published, like, Awakenings and The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. He's, like, everyone knows Oliver Sacks. I never read this book. I've had this book forever. It was published in 2007. I think a student at the high school I taught at, his parents, like, gave, it was like a gift from them for Christmas or something. I don't know. It was one of those books where I have like a hardback copy of it and just hadn't read it, even though it looked so like something I would be interested in. And it's really good so far. I'm like a third of the way in. It's a bunch of separate stories about music and the brain. And he studies a lot of, brain problems. You know, like, people have strokes, or a guy who was struck by lightning. And it's really just gets into the ways that music and our brain interact, times where you hear music without, you know, any prompting, or why a song will get stuck in your head, or what the creative process is like. There's a guy who got struck by lightning and began writing music uncontrollably almost. And he just created music, and he became so obsessed with it. And then he began learning piano, and now he, like, fully plays piano because he was just so obsessed and couldn't let it go. It's really a really cool book, and just rooted in these fascinating stories that Oliver Sacks is a big music lover, and, you know, plays piano and sort of just understands classical music, and he kind of ties it all together with his own experience. It's a really neat book. It's, if you're into, like, music and brain stuff, like, I can't recommend it enough. So,
oh man, that sounds right up your alley.
That's my main. Yeah, it really is. I'm glad I'm finally reading it. So that's Musicophilia, it's called, and it's it's a great book.
Cool. Speaking of Musicophilia, Kirk, what is your music pick of the week?
All right. Well, music pick of the week is a jazz tune. I haven't done a jazz tune in a little while. So this track is from an album called Sketches of Spain, which was released, I think, in the late 50s, '59, by Miles Davis and Gil Evans. So Miles Davis, obviously famous jazz trumpet player. Gil Evans is an arranger and composer who is this amazing guy, and he and Miles Davis did these three albums. They did Porgy and Bess, Sketches of Spain, together, that are these, like, really beautiful, almost chamber music jazz albums in the late 50s. Sketches of Spain was the third one that they did. It's, like, widely seen as one of the greatest jazz albums ever. And I've been listening to it because it's, like, the 60th anniversary of that album, or of them sitting down in the studio to record it. So I thought I would get it on listeners' radars. So here's a track from that album. This is called Will o' the Wisp. I think it's the second track on the record, and it's a really cool album. This is from Sketches of Spain. Davis, he's jazz man.
Jazz Kirk is back.
Yeah,
he's back.
I could talk forever about Sketches of Spain, but I will spare you both and just say it's a good album. People should go listen to it.
You could talk forever about it on your other podcast.
On Strong Songs.
Yeah, I'll probably
do. Are actually...
Yeah, I'll probably do a Gil Evans thing on Strong Songs. More people should know. Everyone knows Miles, but...
Well, I mean, people listen, so you'll talk forever about Miles
Davis. That's true. That's true. So they will not run for the hills.
Bring in the people what they want.
All right. Kirk, Maddie, we will be back next week with a Thanksgiving mailbag episode. So... I guess we will see you. I will see you both then.
Yeah, and people, write in. Everybody, write in with your questions. Splitscreen@kotaku.com.
Send us questions, and we will talk about the most interesting ones. Or the ones we find interesting.
Don't forget to be interesting. It's very important.
Right, I forgot about that.
No, I should say, just because we don't ask your question on the show doesn't mean that it was boring.
No.
Oftentimes, it's just we don't have time for it, or like we're not in the mood for it, or whatever. There are lots of
It is worth pointing out, yes. We get lots of great emails.
True.
Thanks, everybody who writes.
We do get a lot of interesting questions and don't have time to answer them all, but we will hopefully get through some good ones next week.
Yeah.
And yeah, see you guys next time.
See you both in a week.
Bye.
Kotaku Split Screen is the official podcast of Kotaku.com. It's produced by Maddie Myers, Kirk Hamilton, and me, Jason Schreier. Kirk edits and mixes the podcast and also wrote and performed our theme song and other music. You can find us on most popular podcast services, and we hope you'll leave us a review if you like what you hear. Find old episodes at kotaku.com/splitscreen and email us at splitscreen@kotaku.com.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader, like that car riding your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.